Chapter 53 Golding Rescue Camp, 17 August 1848. 22-year-old Robert Golding rushed into rescue camp just after sunset on Thursday, the 17th of August, agitated, shaking, and almost too excited to speak. Mate Robert Thomas interrupted him outside of Crozier's tent.
Golding, I thought you were with Mr. DeVoe's group on the ice.
Yes, sir, I am.
Mr. Thomas.
I was.
Is Mr. DeVoe back already?
No, Mr. Thomas. Mr. DeVoe sent me back with a message for the captain.
You can tell me.
Yes, sir. I mean, no, sir. Mr. DeVoe said I was to report only to the captain.
Just the captain.
Sorry, sir. Thank you, sir.
What in hell is all the commotion out here?
Asked Crozier, crawling out of his tent. Golding repeated his instructions from the second mate to report only to the captain, apologized, stuttered, and was led away from the ring of tents by Crozier.
Now tell me what's going on, Golding. Why aren't you with Mr. DeVoe? Has something happened to him and the reconnaissance group?
Yes, sir. I mean, no, Captain. I mean, something has happened, sir, out there on the ice. I wasn't there when it did. We was left behind to hunt seals, sir. Francis Pocock and Josephus Greater and me, while Mr. DeVoe went on farther south with Robert Johns and Bill Mark and Tom Tadman and the others yesterday. But this evening, they come back. Just Mr. DeVoe and a couple of the others, I mean, about an hour after we heard the shotguns.
Calm down, lad, said Crozier,
setting his hands firmly on the boy's shaking shoulders.
Tell me what Mr. DeVoe's message was, word for word. And then tell me what you saw.
They're both dead, Captain. Both of them. I saw the one, Mr. DeVoe, had her body on a blanket, sir. It was all tore up. But I ain't seen the other one yet.
Who's both dead, Golding?
Snapped Crozier, although the her had already told him part of the truth.
Lady's Island and the thing, Captain. The Eskimo bitch and the thing from the ice. I seen her body. I ain't seen it yet. Mr. DeVoe said it's next to a polyp about another mile out behind where we was shooting at seals, and I'm to bring you and the doctor out to see it, sir.
Polyp, said Crozier. You mean Polynya, one of the little lakes of open water in the ice.
Yes, Captain. I ain't seen that yet, but that's where the thing's carcass is, according to Mr. DeVoe and Fat Wilson, who was with him and carrying and pulling the blanket like it was a sled, sir. Silence. She was in the blanket, you see, all tore up and dead. Mr. DeVoe says to bring you and the doctor and no one else, and for me not to tell no one else, or he'll have Mr. Johnson flog me when he gets back.
Why the doctor? Said Crozier. Are some of our people hurt?
I think so, Captain. I'm not sure. They're still out at the hole in the ice, sir. Pocock and Greater went on back south with Mr. DeVoe and Fat Alex Wilson, like Mr. DV said for them to. But he sent me back here and said to bring just you and the doctor, no one else. And not to tell no one else neither. Not yet. Oh, and for the surgeon to bring his kit with knives and such, and maybe some larger knives for carving up the thing's carcass.
Did you hear the shotgun blasts this evening, Captain? Pocock and Greater and me heard them. And we was a mile away from the polyp at least.
No, we wouldn't make out shotgun reports from 2 miles away over the damnable constant cracking and breaking of the ice here, said Crozier. Think hard, Golding. Why exactly did Mr. DeVoe say it should just be Dr. Goodsir and myself that come out to see whatever it is?
He said he's fairly sure the thing's dead. But Mr. DeVoe said it ain't what we thought it was, Captain. He said it's... I forget the words he used. But Mr. DeVoe says it changes everything, sir. He wants you and the doctor to see it and know what happened there before anyone in the camp hears about it.
What did happen out there? Pressed Crozier.
Golding shook his head.
I don't know, Captain. Pocock and Greater and me was hunting seals, sir. We shot one, Captain, but it slipped through its hole in the ice and we couldn't get to it.
I'm sorry, sir.
Then we heard the shotguns to the south, And a little later, an hour maybe, Mr. Daveau shows up with George Cann, who was bleeding on his face, and Fat Wilson. And Wilson was pulling Silence's body on a blanket he was dragging, and she was all torn to pieces. Only, we're supposed to hurry back, Captain, while the moon's up.
Indeed, it was a rare, clear night, after a rare, clear red sunset. Crozier had been taking his sextant out of its box to get a star fix when he'd heard the commotion, and a huge, full, blue-white moon had just risen over the icebergs and ice jumble to the southeast.
"Why tonight?" asked Crozier. "Can't this wait for morning?"
"Mr. Daveau said it can't, Captain. He said to give you his compliments, and would you be so kind as to bring Dr. Goodsir and come out about 2 miles? It ain't longer than 2 hours' walk, sir, even with the ice walls, to see what's there by the Pollyanna."
"All right," said Crozier. "You go tell Dr. Goodsir I want him, and for him to bring his medical kit and to dress warmly. I'll meet the two of you at the boats."
Golding led the four men out onto the ice. Crozier ignored the message from Daveau to come just with the surgeon, and had ordered Bosun John Lane and Captain of the Hold William Goddard to come along with their shotguns. And then into the jumble of bergs and ice boulders, then over 3 high-pressure ridges, and finally through Serac forests, where Golding's earlier path back to the camp was marked not only by his boot prints in the blowing snow, but also by the bamboo wands they'd hauled with them all the way from Terra. Daveau's group had carried the wands with them 2 days earlier to mark their way back and to show the best pathway through the ice, should they find open water and want the others to follow them with the boats. The moonlight was so bright that it threw shadows. Even the narrow bamboo wands were like moon dials, throwing slashes of shadow lines onto the white-blue ice. For the first hour, there was only the sound of the laboured breathing, their boots crunching on snow and ice, and the cracking and groans all around them. Then Crozier said, "Are you sure she's dead, Golding?"
"Who, sir?"
The captain's frustrated exhalation became a small cloud of ice crystals gleaming in the moonlight.
"How many she's are there around here, goddammit? Lady Silence!"
"Oh, yes, sir," the boy snickered. "She's dead, all right. Her titties was all tore off."
The captain glared at the boy as they climbed another low-pressure ridge and passed into the shadow of a tall, blue-glowing iceberg.
"But are you sure it's Silence? Could it be another native woman?"
Golding seemed stumped by that question.
"Is there more Eskimo women out here, Captain?"
Crozier shook his head and gestured for the boy to continue leading. They reached the Pollyanna, as Golding continued calling it, about an hour and a half after leaving camp.
"I thought you said it was farther out," said Crozier.
"I ain't never been even this far before," said Golding. "I was back there hunting seals when Mr. Daveau found the thing."
He gestured vaguely behind and to the left of where they now stood by the opening in the ice.
"You said some of our people were injured?"
asked Dr. Goodsir.
"Yes, sir. Fat Alex Wilson had blood on his face."
"I thought you said it was George Cann who had a bloody face," said Crozier.
Golding shook his head emphatically.
"Uh-uh, Captain. It was Fat Alex who were bloody." "Was it his own blood? Or someone or something else's?"
asked Goodsir.
"I don't know,"
Golding replied, his voice almost sullen sounding.
"Mr. Daveau just told me to have you bring your surgeon's things. I figured someone had to be hurt if Mr. Daveau needed you to fix him. Well, there's no one around here,"
said the bosun, John Lane, walking carefully around the ice edge of the Pollyanna, which was no more than 25 feet across, and staring first down into the dark water 8 feet lower than the ice, and then back at the forest of Seracs on all sides.
"Where are they? Mr. Daveau had 8 other men besides you with him when he left, Golding." "I don't know, Mr. Lane. This is where he told me to bring you."
Captain of the Hold Goddard cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted, "Hello! Mr. Daveau! Hello!"
There came an answering shout from their right. The voice was indistinct, muffled, but sounded excited. Motioning Golding back, Crozier led the way through the forest of 12-foot-high ice seracs. The wind through the sculpted towers made a moaning, crooning sound, and they all knew that the serac edges were as sharp as knife blades and stronger than most ship knives. Ahead of them in the moonlight, in the center of a small flat ice clearing amid the seracs, the dark form of one man stood alone.
"If that's Devaux," Lane whispered to his captain, "he's got 8 men missing."
Crozier nodded.
"John, William, you two go ahead, slowly. Keep your shotguns ready and on half cock. Dr. Goodsir, please be so kind as to stay back with me. Golding, you wait here."
"Aye, sir," whispered William Goddard.
He and John Lane tugged off their mittens with their teeth so they could use their gloved fingers, raised their weapons, half-cocked one of the heavy hammers on their double-barreled guns, and moved forward cautiously toward the moonlit clearing beyond the edge of the serac forest. A huge shadow came out from behind the last serac and slammed Lane's and Goddard's skulls together. The two men went down like cattle beneath a slaughterhouse sledgehammer. Another shadowy figure struck Crozier in the back of the head, pinned his arms behind his back when he tried to rise, and held a knife to his neck. Robert Golding grabbed Goodsir and set a long blade alongside his throat.
"Don't move, doctor," whispered the boy, "or I'll do my own bit of surgery on you."
The huge shadow lifted Goddard and Lane by the scruff of their greatcoats and dragged them out into the ice clearing. The toes of their boots made grooves in the snow. A third man came from behind the seracs, picked up Goddard's and Lane's shotguns, handed one to Golding and kept the other for himself.
"Get out there,"
said Richard Aylmore, gesturing with the barrels of the shotgun. With a knife still held to his throat by the shadowy shape, Crozier now recognized by smell as the slackered George Thompson, the captain stood and half stumbled, was half pushed out of the serac shadows and toward the man waiting in the moonlight. Magnus Manson dumped the bodies of Lane and Goddard in front of his master, Cornelius Hickey.
"Are they alive?"
rasped Crozier. The captain's arms were still pinned behind him by Thompson, but now that the muzzles of 2 shotguns were trained on him, the blade was no longer at his throat. Hickey leaned over as if to inspect the men, and with 2 smooth, easy moves, cut both their throats with a knife that had suddenly appeared in his hand.
"Not now they ain't alive, Mr. High and Mighty Crozier," said the caulker's mate.
The blood pouring out onto the ice looked black in the moonlight.
"Is that the technique you used to slaughter John Irving?" asked Crozier, his voice shaking with fury.
"Fuck you,"
said Hickey. Crozier glared at Robert Golding.
"I hope you got your 30 pieces of silver."
Golding snickered.
"Charge,"
said the caulker's mate to Thompson, standing behind the captain.
"Crozier carries a pistol in his right greatcoat pocket. Pull it out. Dickie, you bring the pistol back to me. If Crozier moves, kill him."
Thompson removed the pistol, while Aylmore kept his purloined shotgun aimed. Then Aylmore walked over, took the pistol and the box of cartridges Thompson had found, and backed away, shotgun raised again. He crossed the short moonlit space and handed the pistol to Hickey.
"All this natural misery," Dr. Goodsir said suddenly. "Why do you men have to add to it? Why does our species always have to take our full measure of God-given misery and terror and mortality and then make it worse? Can you answer me that, Mr. Hickey?"
The caulker's mate Manson, Aylmore, Thompson and Golding stared at the surgeon as if he had begun speaking Aramaic.
So did the only other living man there, Francis Crozier.
What do you want, Hickey?
Asked Crozier.
Other than more good men dead as meat for your trip.
I want you to shut the fuck up and then die slow and hard, said Hickey.
Robert Golding laughed a demented boy's laugh. The barrels of the shotgun he was holding beat a tattoo on the back of Good Sir's neck.
Mr. Hickey, said Good Sir, you do realize, do you not, that I shall never serve your purposes by dissecting my shipmates?
Hickey showed his small teeth in the moonlight.
You will, surgeon. I guarantee you will. Or you'll watch us cut your pieces off, one at a time, and then have us feed them to you.
Good Sir said nothing.
Tom Johnson and the others are going to find you, Crozier said, never removing his gaze from Cornelius Hickey's face.
The Calker's mate laughed.
Johnson already found us, Crozier, or rather, we found him.
The Calker's mate reached behind him and pulled a burlap bag from the snow.
What did you always call Johnson in private, King Crozier? Your strong right arm. Here.
He tossed a naked and bloody right arm, severed just above the elbow, white bone gleaming through the air, and watched it land at Crozier's feet. Crozier did not look down at it.
You pathetic little smear of spittle. You are, and always have been, nothing.
Hickey's face contorted as if the moonlight were changing him into something non-human. His thin lips drew far back from his tiny teeth in a way that the others had seen only with scurvy victims in their last hours. His eyes showed something beyond madness, far beyond mere hatred.
Magnus, said Hickey, strangle the captain. Slow.
Yes, Cornelius,
said Magnus Manson, and shuffled forward. Good Sir tried to rush forward, but the boy Golding held him fast with one hand, while holding the shotgun to his head with the other. Crozier did not move a muscle as the giant lumbered toward him. When Manson's shadow fell over both the captain and George Thompson holding him, Thompson himself flinched just a bit. Crozier sagged back, lunged forward, freed his left arm, and thrust his hand into the left pocket of his greatcoat. Golding almost pulled the shotgun's trigger, thus almost blowing Good Sir's head off by accident, so startled was he as the captain's coat pocket burst into flame, and the muted double boom of an explosion rolled past them and echoed back from the seracs.
Ouch,
said Magnus Manson, slowly raising his hands to his belly.
God damn it, Crozier said calmly.
He had inadvertently fired both barrels of a two-shot pistol.
Magnus!
Cried Hickey, and rushed forward to the giant.
I think the captain shot me, Cornelius, said Manson.
The big man sounded confused and a little bemused.
Good, sir, shouted Crozier amid the confusion.
The captain whirled, kneed Thompson in the bollocks and broke free.
Run!
The surgeon tried. He pulled, shoved, and almost won his freedom before the younger Golding tripped him, knocked him onto his belly, and set the full pressure of his knee on Goodser's back and the full force of two shotgun barrels against the back of Goodser's skull. Crozier was loping for the seracs. Hickey calmly seized a shotgun from Richard Aylmore, aimed, and fired both barrels. The top of a serac splintered and fell at the same time that Crozier was thrown forward on his face, sliding on the ice and on a film of his own blood. Hickey handed the shotgun back and unbuttoned Manson's coats and waistcoats, ripping open the big man's shirts and filthy undershirt.
Bring the fucking surgeon over here, he shouted at Golding.
It don't hurt much, Cornelius,
rumbled Magnus Manson.
tickles more like.
Golding shoved, prodded and dragged good sir over. The surgeon put on his glasses and inspected the twin wounds.
I'm not certain, but I don't believe the small caliber bullets penetrated Mr. Manson's subcutaneous fat, much less his muscle layer. It's little more than two minor punctures, I fear. Now, may I go attend to Captain Crozier, Mr. Hickey?
Hickey laughed.
Cornelius!
Shouted Aylmore. Crozier, leaving a trail of blood and shredded outer clothing, had gotten to his knees and begun crawling toward the seracs and serac shadows. Now he painfully got to his feet. He staggered drunkenly toward the ice columns. Golding giggled and raised his shotgun.
No!
Cried Hickey. He pulled Crozier's big percussion cap pistol from his coat pocket and took careful aim. 20 feet from the seracs, Crozier looked back over his shredded shoulder. Hickey fired. The bullet spun Crozier around and dropped him to his knees. His body sagged, but he flailed and thrust one hand down onto the ice in an attempt to rise. Hickey took 5 steps forward and fired again. Crozier was thrown backward and lay on his back with only his knees in the air. Hickey took 2 more steps, aimed, and fired again. One of Crozier's legs was knocked aside and down as the bullet tore through the knee or the muscle just below the knee. The captain made no sound.
Cornelius, honey.
Magnus Manson's voice had the tone of an injured child.
My stomach is starting to hurt.
Hickey wheeled.
Good sir, give him something for the pain.
The surgeon nodded. His voice, when he spoke, was very thin and very tight and very flat.
I brought an entire bottle of Davos powder, mostly made from a derivative of the coca plant, sometimes called cocaine. I'll give him that. All of it, if you like. With a chaser of mandragora, laudanum, and morphine. That will take away the pain.
He reached into his medical kit. Hickey raised the pistol and aimed it at the surgeon's left eye.
If you even make Magnus sick to his stomach, much less if your fucking hand comes out of that bag with a scalpel or other blade, I swear to fucking Christ, I'll shoot you in the balls and keep you alive long enough to make you eat them. Do you understand, surgeon?
I understand, said good sir. But it is the Hippocratic Oath that determines my next actions.
He brought out a bottle and a spoon and poured out a tiny bit of liquid morphine.
Sip this, he said to the giant.
Thank you, doctor,
said Magnus Manson. He slurped soundly.
Cornelius!
Cried Thompson, pointing. Crozier was gone. Bloody smears led into the seracs.
Oh, fuck me,
said the Kulka's mate with a sigh.
This asshole is more trouble than he is worth. Dickie, have you reloaded?
Hickey was reloading the pistol as he asked the question.
Aye,
said Aylmore, lifting the shotgun.
Thompson, pick up the extra shotgun I brought and stay here with Magnus and the surgeon. If the good doctor does anything at all that you don't like, even farts, blow his private parts off.
Thompson nodded. Golding giggled. Hickey, with his pistol, and Golding and Aylmore with their shotguns, advanced slowly across the moonlit ice and then tentatively single file into the forest of seracs and shadows.
He could be hard to find in here,
whispered Aylmore as they stepped into the stripes of moonlight and darkness.
I don't think so,
said Hickey, and pointed at the broad smear of blood that led straight ahead between the ice columns like a telegraph code of black dots and dashes between the shadows.
He still has a little pistol with him,
whispered Aylmore, moving cautiously from serac to serac.
Fuck him and fuck his pistol,
said Hickey, striding straight ahead, his boots slipping a bit on the blood and ice. Golding giggled loudly.
Fuck him and fuck his little pistol,
he said in a sing-song voice, snickering again. The blood trail ended 40 feet in at the Black Polynya. Hickey rushed forward and stared down at where the horizontal smears became vertical smears on the side of the 8-foot ice slab. Something had gone into the water here.
God damn it to goddamn fucking hell,
cried Hickey, pacing back and forth.
I wanted to put that last bullet into the high and mighty king's fucking face while he watched. God damn him, he robbed me.
Look, Mr. Hickey, sir,
said Golding, giggling. He pointed to what might be a body floating face down in the dark water.
It's only the fucking coat, said Aylmore,
who had come cautiously out of the shadows with his shotgun raised.
Only the fucking coat, repeated Robert Golding.
So he's dead down there, said Aylmore. Can we get out of here before DeVoe or someone comes to the sound of all the shooting? It's 2 days back to the others, and we still have the bodies to cut up before we can leave.
No one's going anywhere yet, said the caulker's mate. Crozier may still be alive.
Oh, shut up like that, without his coat, asked Aylmore. And look at the great coat, Cornelius. The shotgun tore it apart.
He may still be alive. We're going to make sure he's not. Maybe the body will float to the surface.
What are you going to do? Asked Aylmore. Shoot his dead body?
Hickey wheeled on the man and glared, making the much taller Aylmore step back.
Yes, said Cornelius Hickey. That's precisely what I'm going to do.
To Golding, he barked.
Go bring Thompson and Magnus and the surgeon. We'll tie up the doctor tight to one of them seracs while Aylmore and Thompson and me search. And you watch over Magnus and cut Lane and Goddard into small enough to haul easy-like bits.
Me? Cut them up?
Cried Golding.
You told me that's why we were grabbing Good Sir Cornelius. He was supposed to do all the cutting up, not me. Good Sir will do the carving in the future, Bobby,
said Hickey.
Tonight you have to do it. We can't trust Dr. Good Sir yet. Not until we get him back with our people and many miles away from here. You be a good boy and go get the doctor and tie him up to a sarak. Tight, use your best knots. And tell Magnus to bring the carcasses over here where you can carve them. And get blades from Good Sir's kit and the big knives and carpenter's saw I brung that are over in the bag.
Oh, all right, said Golding. But I'd rather search.
He trudged back out of the sarak field.
The captain must have left half his blood between where you shot him and here, Cornelius,
said Aylmore.
If he didn't go into the water, he can't hide anywhere here without leaving a trail.
That is precisely correct, Dickie, my dear,
said Hickey with a strange smile.
If he's not in the water, he might crawl, but he cannot stop losing blood with wounds like that. We are going to search until we are sure he ain't under the water, nor curled up somewhere here in the seracs where he crawled and hid and bled himself to death. You start over there on the south side of the Polynya. I'll look to the north. We'll go clockwise. If you see any wee sign, even a drop of blood, even a scuff in the snow, shout and stop. I'll join you. And be careful. We don't want the dying fucker jumping out of the shadows and grabbing one of our guns now, do we?
Aylmore looked surprised and alarmed.
Do you really think he could be strong enough to do that? With 3 bullets, and all those shotgun pellets in him, I mean. Without his coat, he'd freeze to death in a few minutes anyway. It's getting much colder and the wind's getting stronger. Do you really think he's lying in wait for us, Cornelius?
Hickey smiled and nodded toward the black pool.
No, I think he's dead and drowned and down there. But we're going to make fucking sure. We're not leaving here until we're sure, even if we got to search until the god-poxed sun comes up.
In the end, They searched for 3 hours under the light of the rising and then descending moon. There were no signs at all near the Polynya, nor amid the Seracs, nor on the open ice fields beyond the Seracs in all directions, nor on the high-pressure ridges to the north and south and east. No blood trails, no footprints, no drag marks. It took Robert Golding the full 3 hours to hack John Lane and William Goddard into the size pieces that Hickey had asked for. And even then the boy made a dreadful mess of it. Ribs, heads, hands, feet, and sections of spinal cord lay around him on all sides, as if there had been an explosion in an abattoir. And young Golding himself was so covered with blood that he looked like a player in a minstrel show by the time Hickey and the others got back. Aylmore, Thompson, and even Magnus Manson were taken aback by their young apprentice's appearance, but Hickey laughed long and hard. The gunny sacks and burlap bags were filled with meat wrapped in oilcloths they'd brought. Yet still, the bags leaked. They untied good sir, who was shaking from the cold or shock.
"Time to go, surgeon," said Hickey. "The other chaps are waiting 10 miles west of here on the ice to welcome you home."
Good sir said,
"Mr. DeVoe and the others will come after you."
"No,"
said Cornelius Hickey, his voice showing his absolute certainty.
"They won't. Not with them knowing that now we got at least 3 shotguns and a pistol. And that's if they ever find out we was here, which I think they won't."
To Golding, he said,
"Give our new crewmate a sack of meat to carry, Bobby."
When good sir refused to accept the bulging sack from Golding, Magnus Manson knocked him down, almost breaking the surgeon's ribs. On the 4th attempt to hand him the dripping bag, after 2 more serious cuffings, the surgeon took it.
"Let's go," said Hickey. "We're done here."
Chapter 54, DeVoe. Rescue Camp, 19 August, 1848. First Mate Charles DeVoe could not restrain himself from grinning as he and his 8 men returned to rescue camp on the morning of Saturday, 19 August. For a change, he had nothing but good news to deliver to his captain and the men. The ice pack had opened to floes and navigable leads only 4 miles out, and DeVoe and his men had spent another day following the leads south until the strait became open water, all the way to the Adelaide Peninsula, and almost certainly to the inlet to Back River, farther east around that peninsula. DeVoe had seen the low hills of the Adelaide Peninsula, less than 12 open water miles away from an iceberg they'd climbed, at their farthest south extension of the ice pack. They could go no farther without a boat, which had made First Mate DeVoe grin broadly then, and which made him grin again now. Everyone could leave rescue camp. Everyone there now had a chance at survival. Almost better news to bring home was the fact that they had spent 2 days shooting seals on the floes at the edge of the new open sea out there on the strait. For 2 days and nights, DeVoe and his men had gorged themselves on seal meat and blubber, their bodies craving the fat so much that even though the rich food made them sick, after weeks of only ship's biscuits and slivers of old salt pork, vomiting just made them hungrier, and they laughed and began gorging again almost immediately. Each of his 8 men was dragging a carcass of a seal behind him now, as they followed the bamboo wands across the last mile of coastal ice to the camp. The 46 men in rescue camp would eat well tonight, as would again the 8 triumphant explorers. All in all, DeVoe thought as they came up the shingle past the boats, hallooing and hurrahing to get the camp's attention, other than the young squirt Golding turning back on his own that first day because of a bellyache, it had been almost a perfect expedition. For the first time in months, in years, Captain Crozier and the others would have news to celebrate. They were all going home. If they left today, the healthy among them, man-hauling the ill in the boats only the 4 miles on the winding trail through pressure ridges that DeVoe had carefully charted, they would be afloat within 3 or 4 days, to the mouth of Back's Great Fish River within the week. And it was probable that the opening leads had advanced even closer to shore by now. Filthy, ragged, slumped creatures emerged from their tents and left their desultory camp chores to come out to stare at DeVoe's party. The cheering of DeVoe's men, Fat Alex Wilson, Francis Pocock, Josephus Greater, George Cann, Robert Johns, Thomas Tadman, Thomas McConvey and William Mark, died as they looked at the dour, immobile, haunted-eyed faces of the men facing them. The men from the camp could see the seals being dragged, but they seemed to have no reaction. Mates Couch and Thomas came out of their tents and down the shingle to stand in front of the line of rescue camp spectres. "Did someone die?" asked Charles Frederick DeVoe. Second mate Edward Couch, first mate Robert Thomas, first mate Charles DeVoe, Erebus captain of the hold Joseph Andrews, and Terror captain of the maintop Thomas Farr were crowded into the oversized tent that had been used as Dr. Goodsir's hospital. The amputees, DeVoe had learned, had either died in the 4 days he was gone or been moved back to smaller tents shared with the other sick men. These five in this tent this morning were the last officers with any command authority left alive, or at least at rescue camp and well enough to walk, from the entire John Franklin expedition. They had just enough tobacco left for four of the five. Farr did not smoke, to have their pipes going. The interior of the tent was filled with blue smoke. "Are you sure it wasn't the thing from the ice that committed the carnage you found out there?" asked DeVoe. Couch shook his head. "We thought that might be the case at first. In fact, that was our assumption, but the bones and heads and remaining pieces of flesh we found..." He stopped and bit down hard on the stem of pipe. "Had knife marks on them," finished Robert Thomas. "Lane and Goddard were butchered by a human being." "Not a human being," said Thomas Farr, "but some vile thing in the shape of a man."
"Hickey," said DeVoe.
The others nodded.
"We have to go after him and the murderers with him," said DeVoe.
No one spoke for a moment. Then Robert Thomas said,
"Why?"
"To bring them to justice."
Four of the five men looked at one another. "They have three shotguns now," said Couch, "and almost certainly the captain's percussion cap pistol."
"We have more men, guns, powder, shot, cartridges," said DeVoe.
"Aye," said Thomas Farr. "And how many of them would die in a battle with Hickey and his 15 cannibals? Thomas Johnson ne'er come back, you know. His job was just to track Hickey's band, make sure they was leaving like they said they was."
"I can't believe this," said DeVoe, removing his pipe and tamping at the bowl.
"What about Captain Crozier and Dr. Goodsir? Are you just going to abandon them? Leave them to Cornelius Hickey's whims?"
"The captain ain't alive," said Captain of the Hold Andrews. "Hickey wouldn't have no reason to keep Crozier alive, unless it was to torture and torment him."
"All the more reason to send a rescue party after them," insisted DeVoe. The others did not respond for a moment. The blue smoke swirled around them. Thomas Farr untied the tent door and opened it wider to let some air in and smoke out.
"It's been almost 2 days since whatever happened out on the ice happened," said Edward Couch. "It would be several more days before any party we sent could find and fight Hickey's group, even if they could find them. All the devil has to do is travel farther out on the ice or inland to throw us off. The wind obscures tracks in hours, even sledge tracks. Do you really think Francis Crozier, if he's alive now, which I doubt, would be alive or in any shape to be rescued in 5 days or a week?"
DeVoe chewed the stem of his pipe.
"Dr. Goodsir, then. We need the surgeon. Logic dictates that Hickey would keep him alive. Goodsir may be the reason Hickey and his accomplices came back."
Robert Thomas shook his head.
Cornelius Hickey may need Dr. Good Sir for his own infernal purposes, but we don't any longer.
What do you mean?
I mean that most of our good surgeon's potions and instruments were left behind. He brought only his portable medical kit, said Farr. And Thomas Hartnell, who's been his assistant, knows which potions to administer and how much and for what.
What about actual surgery? Asked Devoe. Couch smiled sadly. Lad, do you really think that anyone who needs actual surgery from this point in on our travels is likely to survive, no matter what? Devoe did not answer.
And what if Hickey and his men ain't going nowhere? Asked Andrews. And never planned to. He come back to kill the captain, grab Good Sir, and take poor John Lane and Bill Goddard and carve them up like animals. He sees us all as livestock. What if he's just waiting out there beyond the next rise, waiting to attack the whole camp?
You're turning the Kolka's mate into a bogeyman, said Devoe.
He's done that to himself already, said Andrews.
But not a bogeyman. The devil. The actual devil. Him and his team monster Magnus Manson.
They sold their souls, God damn them, and received some dark power for it. Mark my words.
You'd think that one monster would be enough for any Arctic expedition, said Robert Thomas.
No one laughed. It's all one real monster, Edward Couch said at last, and not a new one to our race. So, what are you all suggesting? Devoe asked after another spell of silence. That we run from a 5-foot-tall demon Kolka's mate and just head south with the boats tomorrow?
Me, I'm saying we leave today, said Joseph Andrews, as soon as we load the boats with the few things we're taking. Manhaul through the night. With luck, there'll be enough moonlight to guide by when she rises. If not, we use some of the lantern fuel we kept back. You said yourself, Charles, that the wands is still out there, marking the way. They won't be after the first real storm blows through.
Couch shook his head. Devoe's men are tired. Our people are totally demoralized. Let's have a feast tonight. Eat every one of those 8 seals you brought in, Charles. Then leave tomorrow morning. We'll all have more of a sense of hope after a big meal. Some cooking and light using the seal oil. And a good night's sleep.
But with men on watch tonight, said Andrews.
Oh, aye, said Couch. I'll stand watch myself. I'm not that hungry anyway.
There's the question of command, said Thomas Farr, looking from face to face in the dim light filtering through the canvas.
Several of the men sighed.
Charles is in overall command, said First Mate Robert Thomas. Sir John himself promoted him as First Mate of the flagship when Graham Gore got killed, so he's senior officer. But you were the First Mate on Terra, Robert,
Farr said to Thomas.
You have seniority.
Thomas shook his head adamantly.
Erebus was the command ship. When Gore was alive, it was understood that he had overall expedition command above mine. Charles has got Gore's job now. He's in charge. I don't mind. Mr. Devoe is a better leader than me, and we're going to need leadership.
I can't believe that Captain Crozier's gone, said Andrews.
4 of the 5 men smoked harder. No one spoke. They could hear men outside talking about the seals, someone laughing, and beyond that, the cracking and rifle fire of ice breaking.
Technically, said Thomas Farr, Lieutenant George Henry Hodgson is in charge of the expedition now.
Oh, fuck Lieutenant George Henry Hodgson up the arse with a hot poker, said Joseph Andrews. If the little weasel were to come crawling back now, I'd strangle him with my own hands and piss on his corpse.
I doubt very much if Lieutenant Hodgson is still alive, Devoe said softly. It's decided then that I'm in overall command of the expedition now, with Robert second in command, Edward as third.
Aye,
said the other 4 men in the tent. Then understand that I'm going to keep conferring with the 4 of you, as we have to make decisions, said Devoe. I've always wanted to be captain of my own ship, but not this fucking way. I'm going to need your help. Everyone nodded behind their screen of pipe smoke. I have one question before we go out and tell the men to start preparing for the feast today and departure tomorrow, said Couch. Devoe, who was bareheaded in the heat of the tent, raised his eyebrows. What about the sick men? Hartnell tells me that there are six who can't walk, even if their lives depended on it. Too far gone in scurvy. Take Jobson, the captain's steward, for instance. Mr. Helpman and our engineer Thompson are dead, but Jobson keeps hanging on. Hartnell says he can't even lift his head to drink. He has to be helped. But he's still alive. Do we take him with us? Devoe looked at Couch, and then at the other three faces for unspoken answers, but they gave him nothing. And if we do take Jobson and the other dying ones, continued Couch, what do we take them as? Devoe did not have to ask what the second mate meant. Do we haul them along as shipmates or as food? If we leave them here, he said, there'll sure as hell be food if Hickey comes back the way some of you think he will. Couch shook his head. That isn't what I'm asking. I know, said Devoe. He took a deep breath, almost coughing because of the thick pipe smoke. All right, he said. Here is my first decision as new commander of the Franklin Expedition. When we drag the boats to the ice in the morning, any man who can walk to the boats and get into harness, or even into one of the boats, comes with us. If he dies on the way, we'll decide then whether to haul his body farther. I'll decide. But tomorrow morning, only those who can walk to the boats will leave rescue camp. None of the other men spoke, but several nodded. No one met Devoe's gaze. I'll tell the men after we eat, said Devoe. Each of you four choose one reliable man to join you on watch tonight. Edward will set the schedule. Don't let those men eat themselves into oblivion. We need our wits about us, at least some of us, until we get safely to the open water. All four men nodded at this. All right. Go tell your men about the feast, said Devoe. We're done here. Chapter 55. Good Sir. 20 August 1848. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Good Sir.
Saturday, 20 August 1848. The devil, Hickey, seems to have all the good fortune so denied to Sir John, Commander Fitzjames, and Captain Crozier for so many months and years. They do not know that I had inadvertently put my diary into my medical kit. Or rather, they probably know, since they thoroughly searched my kit 2 nights ago after taking me captive. But they do not care. I sleep alone in a tent, except for Lieutenant Hodgson, who is as much captive now as I am, and he does not mind my scribbling in the dark. Part of me still cannot believe the slaughter of my comrades, Lane, Goddard, and Crozier. And had I not seen with my own eyes the feast of human flesh, half of Hickey's party celebrated late Friday night upon our return to this sledge camp, out on the ice not far from our old river camp, I still might not believe in such barbarism. Not all of Hickey's infernal legion have yet succumbed to the lure of cannibalism. Hickey, Manson, Thompson, and Aylmore are enthusiastic participants, of course, as are, it turns out, Seaman William Oren, Steward William Gibson, Stoker Luke Smith Golding, Calker James Brown, and his mate Dunn. But others abstain alongside myself. Morfan, Best, Jerry, Work, Strickland, Seeley, and of course Hodgson. We are all subsisting on mouldy ship's biscuits. Of those fellow abstainers, I suspect that only Strickland or Morfan and the lieutenant may continue to resist for long. Hickey's people have caught just one seal on their voyage west along the coast, but that was enough to power a stove with its oil. and the smell of roasting human flesh is horribly enticing. Hickey has not harmed me yet. Not even the past 2 nights when I have refused to partake of the meal or to agree to cut other bodies up when the time comes. So far, Mr. Lane and Mr. Goddard's parts have assuaged their appetite and freed me from having to decide between becoming a chef for cannibals or being maimed and carved myself. But no one is allowed to touch the shotguns other than Mr. Hickey, Mr. Aylmore, or Mr. Thompson. These last two have become lieutenants of the new Bonaparte that is our diminutive caulker's mate, and Magnus Manson is a weapon of his own, which only one man, if he is indeed still a man, can aim and unleash. But when I speak of Hickey's fortune, I do not speak of just the luck of his own dark making that brought him a source of fresh meat. Rather, I refer to today's revelation when, just 2 miles northwest and offshore of our old river camp, where Mr. Bridgens went missing, we came upon open leads that stretched westward along the coast. Hickey's depraved crew unsledged, rigged, loaded, and launched the pinnace almost at once, and we have been sailing and rowing quickly along to the west ever since. You might ask, how can 17 men fit into a 28-foot open boat, meant to carry only 8 to 12 men comfortably? The answer is that we crowd upon each other terribly, and, even though we haul only tents, weapons, cartridges, water casks, ourselves and our terrible food supply, we are so heavily laden that the sea rises almost to the gunwales on either side, especially when the width of the leads allows us to tack into the wind without the use of oars. I heard Hickey and Aylmore whispering after we landed to pitch tents this evening. They made little effort to lower their voices. Someone will have to go. The water is open ahead. The way is free. Perhaps all the way back to Terra Camp, or even to Terra herself, just as the prophet Cornelius Hickey insisted during the confrontation with Crozier at the unnamed bay in July, where mutiny was avoided only by the shout of open water. And it may well occur that Hickey and those who remain with him will be back at Terra Camp and the ship in 3 days of easy sailing rather than the 3.5 months of brutal man-hauling it took us to come the same distance in the opposite direction. But now that they do not need man-haulers, which men will be sacrificed to the food stores so that the boat can be lightened for tomorrow's sailing? Hickey and his giant, and Aylmore, and the other leaders are walking through camp as I write, calling us peremptorily out of our tents, although the hour is late and the night is dark. If I am alive tomorrow, I will write more then.
Chapter 56. Jobson. Rescue Camp, 20 August, 1848. They were treating him like an old man, and leaving him behind because they thought he was an old man, used up, dying even. But that was ridiculous. Thomas Jobson was only 31 years old. Today, the 20th of August, he turned 31 years old. It was his birthday, and none of them except Captain Crozier, who had quit coming to see him in his sick tent for some unknown reason, even knew it was his birthday. They were treating him like an old man, because almost all of his teeth had fallen out from the scurvy, and most of his hair had fallen out for some reason he did not understand. And he was bleeding from his gums and eyes and hairline and anus. But he was not an old man. He was 31 years old today, and they were leaving him behind to die on his birthday. Jobson heard the revelries the afternoon and evening before. Impressions and memories of the shouting and laughter and smell of roasting food were not connected since he had been shifting in and out of fevered consciousness all that previous day. But he had wakened in the twilight to find that someone had brought a plate holding a slab of oily sealskin, strips of dripping white blubber, and a fish-smelling stripe of almost raw red seal meat. Jobson vomited.
Nothing had come up because he had not eaten for a day, or days, and shoved the offending plate of offal out the open tent door. He'd understood that they were leaving him when crewmate after crewmate came by his tent later in the evening, saying nothing, not even showing their faces, but each shoving in one or two rock-hard and half-green ship's biscuits, stacking them by his side like so many white rocks in preparation for his burial. He was too weak to protest then, and too preoccupied with his dreams. But he had known that these few lousy lumps of half-baked and fully stale flour were all he was to receive for his years of faithful service to the Navy, to the Discovery Service, and to Captain Crozier. They were leaving him behind. This Sunday morning he awoke more clear-headed than he had been in some days, perhaps in weeks, only to hear his shipmates' preparations to leave rescue camp forever. There was shouting down by the boats as the two whaleboats were righted, and as the two cutters were readied on their sledges, and as all four boats were loaded.
How could they leave me behind?
Jobson had trouble believing they could or would. Hadn't he stayed by Captain Crozier's side 100 times during the captain's illnesses and moody low points and outright bouts of drunkenness? Hadn't he quietly, uncomplainingly, like the good steward he was, hauled pails of vomit from the captain's cabin in the middle of the night and wiped the Irish drunkard's arse when he shat himself in his fever deliriums?
Perhaps that's why the bastard is leaving me to die.
Jobson forced his eyes open and tried to roll over in his sodden sleeping bag. It was very difficult. The weakness radiating out from his center consumed him. His head threatened to burst with pain every time he opened his eyes. The earth pitched against him as fiercely as any ship he'd ever ridden around the Horn in high seas. His bones ached.
Wait for me! He shouted.
He thought he had shouted it, but it had been only a silent thought. He would have to do better than that. Catch up to them before they shoved the boats out onto the ice. Show them that he could man-haul with the best of them. He might even fool them by being able to force down some of their reeking, rotten seal meat. Jobson could not believe that they were treating him like a dead man. He was a living human being with a good naval record and excellent experience as a personal steward and with as solid a private history as a loyal citizen of Her Majesty's as any other man on the expedition, not to mention a family and a home in Portsmouth, if Elizabeth and his son Avery were still alive, and if they'd not been evicted from the home they'd rented with Thomas Jobson's Discovery Service river pay advance of £28 against his first year's expedition salary of £65. Rescue camp now seemed empty, except for a few low moans that could be coming from nearby tents, or could be merely the incessant wind. The usual crunch of boots on gravel, soft cursing, rare laughter, the small talk of men going to and from watch, shouts between tents, echoes of hammer or saw, the smell of pipe tobacco, all were absent, except for faint and receding noises from the direction of the boats. The men were really leaving. Thomas Jobson was not going to stay here and die in this cold arse end of the world temporary camp. Using all of the strength he had, and some he knew he did not have, Jobson pulled his Hudson's Bay blanket sleeping bag down past his shoulders and began creeping his way out of it. The operation was made no simpler by the fact that strands of frozen sweat, blood, and other bodily fluids had to be ripped free of flesh and wool, for he could crawl out of the blanket and toward the tent opening. Moving what seemed like miles on his elbows, Jobson collapsed forward through the tent flap and gasped at how cold the air outside was. He had grown so used to the canvas-filtered dim light and stuffy air of his tent womb that this openness and glare made his lungs labour and filled his squinted shut eyes with tears. Jobson soon realised that the sun's glare was illusory. Indeed, the morning was dark and thickly fogged, with tendrils of icy vapour moving between the tents like the spirits of all those dead men they'd left behind. It reminded the captain's steward of the thick fog on the day they'd sent Lieutenant Little, Ice Master Reed, Harry Pegler, and the others forward down the first open lead in the ice. "To their deaths," thought Jobson. Crawling over the ship's biscuits and seal meat, brought to him as if he were some damned pagan idol or sacrificial offering to the gods, Jobson pulled his unfeeling and unresponsive legs out through the circular tent opening. He saw two or three tents standing nearby, and for a second he was filled with the hope that the absence of ambulatory men here was temporary, that they were all busy doing something near the boats and would soon be back. But then Jobson saw that most of the Holland tents were missing.
No, not missing,
he could see now, as his eyes adapted to the diffuse light leaking through the fog, that the majority of tents here on the south end of the camp, nearest to the boats and shoreline, had been collapsed, with rocks tossed atop them to keep them from blowing away. Jobson was confused. If they were actually leaving, wouldn't they be bringing the tents along? It was as if they planned to go out on the ice but then return soon. To where and why? None of it made any sense to the sick and recently hallucinatory steward. Then the fog shifted and lifted, and he could see 50 yards or so to where the men were pulling, pushing and tugging from the sides on the boats, hauling them out onto the ice. Jobson estimated that there were at least 10 men per boat, which meant that all or almost all of the survivors here at camp were leaving him and the other really sick men behind.
"How can Dr. Goodsir leave me behind?" wondered Jobson.
He tried to remember the last time it had been the surgeon who had lifted his head and shoulders to feed him broth or to clean him. It was young Hartnell yesterday, wasn't it? Or had that been several days ago? He could not recall the last time the surgeon had looked in on him or brought him medicine.
"Wait!" he called.
Only it had not been a call. It had hardly been a croak. Jobson realized that he had not spoken aloud for days, perhaps weeks, and the noise he'd just made sounded muted and muffled even to his own ringing ears.
"Wait!"
That had been no better. He realized that he had to wave his arm in the air, make them see him, make them turn back for him. Thomas Jobson could not raise either arm. Even trying to do so caused him to fall forward, his face striking the gravel. There was nothing for it. He would just have to crawl toward them until they saw him and turned back. They wouldn't leave behind a fellow crewmate healthy enough to crawl 100 yards after them onto the ice. Jobson wriggled forward on his torn elbows another 3 feet and collapsed face down onto the icy gravel again. The fog roiled around him, obscuring even his own tent a few paces behind him. The wind moaned, or perhaps it was more abandoned sick souls moaning in the few tents still standing, and the chill of the cold day cut right through his filthy wool shirt and soiled trousers. He realized that if he kept crawling away from his tent, he might not have the strength to crawl back and would die of the cold and damp out here.
"Wait!"
he called. His voice was as weak and mewling as a newborn kitten's. He crawled and wriggled and writhed another 3 feet, 4, and lay gasping like a harpooned seal. His weakened, dragging arms and hands were of no more use than flippers would be, of less use. Jobson tried digging his chin into the frozen earth to propel himself forward another 1 or 2. He immediately chipped one of his last remaining teeth in 2, but dug his chin in again for another try. His body was simply too heavy. It seemed attached to the earth by great weights.
I am only 31 years old, he thought fiercely, angrily. Today is my birthday. Wait. 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 Wait.
Each syllable was weaker than the last. Panting. Gasping. His remaining strands of hair dabbing crimson streaks onto the rounded stones. Jobson lay on his belly, his dead arms at his sides, painfully cocked his neck and settled his cheek against the cold earth so that he could see straight ahead.
Wait!
The fog swirled and then lifted. He could see 100 yards. Past the odd vacuity where the boats had been lined up, past the shingle of shore gravel and the tumble of shore ice, out onto the ice itself where 40-some men and 4 boats, where is the 5th, struggled southward, deeper onto the ice. The men's own weakness evident, even at this distance, their own progress not that much more efficient or elegant than Jobson's 5-yard struggle had been.
Wait!
This last shout had taken the penultimate ounce of draining energy. Jobson could feel his core's warmth flowing away into the icy ground beneath him, but it had come out as loud as any spoken word he had ever uttered.
Wait!
He finally shouted. It was a man's voice now, not a kitten's mewl or dying seal's squeak. But it was too late. The men and boats were 100 yards out now and disappearing fast. Mere black, staggering silhouettes against an eternal background of grey and grey. And the cracking and groaning of ice and wind would have covered the sound of a rifle shot, much less a solitary voice of one man left behind. For an instant, the fog lifted more, and a benevolent light fell on everything, as if the sun were coming out to melt the ice everywhere and to bring green tendrils and living things and hope back when none existed here before. But then the fog closed in and swirled around Jobson, blinding him and binding him with its clammy, cold grey fingers. And then the men and the boats were gone. It was as if they had never existed.